Hello, welcome to Books on the Go, a podcast where we talk about our book of the week. I'm Anna Bailey Carris and I'm here with Annie Waters. Hi, Annie.
Hello.
And this week we've been reading Bluebird, Bluebird by Attica Locke. But first, book news, and we have some more awards this week. The ABA Bookseller Prize for Book of the Year. Mm-hmm. Is that the Australian Booksellers Association?
Yes, it is.
Just reminding myself. Mm-hmm. And Annie, I feel like the Booker Prize set a really dangerous precedent here because we have another tie.
Maybe. I mean, I think this is a lot lower stakes. I don't know what the prize money is here. And I think these are two more deserving books to split the field. Yes. Also, I think this prize is voted on by booksellers, so it probably was a genuine tie.
It might have been
votes per book. So
isn't
I think
that interesting because it would be quite a few voting, I assume.
Yeah.
So the two books, drumroll, were There Was Still Love by Favell Parrott and The Yield by Tara June Winch.
Which
so
you loved There Was Still Love and I loved The Yield. So I think, you
it's
know.
It's a tie at Books on the Go
and
as
we're
well.
Very happy.
So we're happy with that. And the Orwell Prize for Political Fiction has been announced overnight and that was won by Colson Whitehead for The Nickel Boys and that was for its convincing character portrayal and unsparing depiction of corruption and racial brutality. Mm. And we just did that on the podcast and really loved it. And that description is accurate and it's a very worthy winner, but that makes you, it makes it sound like a really,
really
depressing read, doesn't it? And as we talked about, it was such a,
does have some humour,
a great, engaging and not overly bleak book on the whole.
Yeah. But I think that makes it a more political book in a way because it is more accessible. You don't have to feel daunted about picking it up.
Yes, absolutely. So a worthy winner as well. In other news this week, Jack Monroe has criticised David Walliams. So Jack Monroe is a British food writer and activist and they campaign on poverty issues and particularly hunger relief and they are non-binary. So Jack Monroe was saying on Twitter their son has been reading the David Walliams books and so they picked it up and were having a read and just said, what is this? It's sort of classist and fat jokes and
sexist.
It's
very lazy, I think, is what it boils down to. The humour is exactly what you would expect from someone who was on Little Britain and now writes books for children.
Yeah. And it's that idea of poking fun at people who are easy targets in a way.
Punching down.
So someone who's poor must be dumb or someone who's fat will all have a laugh at them. Mm. And that sort of, as you say, lazy humour. Mm. So quite valid. I mean, he does make his readers laugh. And so as there was an article in the Times that I didn't read the article because I don't subscribe, but there was at the headline was children don't need David Walliams to be politically correct, which I thought was really interesting. And a lot of kids just find him really funny in that, you know, because I suppose there's maybe an element of things that they're told not to do, like don't, you know, no toilet talk at the dinner table or whatever. And then it's in the book and so they find it naughty.
Yeah,
and
it's titillating in a way.
It's titillating and it's funny.
But I think
they have a big laugh and perhaps from their point of view, you know, they don't care if it's politically correct, obviously, and you can see that by the huge success of the books. But on the other hand, I think Jack Monroe's point is this man sells so many books and is so influential, like 39
million.
He needs
to be held to a
that
standard.
there is an influence there.
I think there's a point to be made about him being a celebrity writer of children's books. I often am a bit squeamish when celebrities write books for children as just a kind of another trick, you know, another feather in their bow. Feather in their cap, I'm mixing my metaphors, another arrow in their bow that it just makes this seamless transition from often comedy or from TV to children's book writing, which I think is a highly specialised art and there must be hundreds if not thousands of children's book authors who are more talented but don't get the kind of promotional marketing budgets that Walliams gets.
Yes,
and
that's
so
true.
I think that was part of their point too, saying that why do we hold this person up? And especially the comparisons to Roald Dahl. I think Roald Dahl had many of the same kind of tropes of, you know, jokes about nasty people and jokes about fat people, but I think that his were always almost with an opposite intention that, yes, you know, that the morality of Roald Dahl is really strong. And that I think...
Well, he had a more... He was partly Norwegian, wasn't he? He had a more European sensibility. Mm. So it's not that laddish English humour, with
it's
Roald
not,
Dahl.
Yeah, kind of...
If anything, it's gutter. Gothic.
Yeah, yeah.
Norse. Well,
and the baddies always kind of get their comeuppance in a really apt, fitting way.
Yeah.
Whereas... I mean, I haven't read any of David Williams's books, so I can't comment directly to that. But I think my impression of them is much more just relying on those cheap laughs and
it's the cheap
tell
laughs.
A silly yeah. story. You know?
Yeah, and he does it well. I think he's transcended being a celebrity who writes books. I would sort of look at him as a genuine author, and he's certainly my daughter never got on with his books, but my 8-year-old son loves them,
yep.
and so that's his market. Mm. And he does it. I think he does it really well. But that's not to say, as you say, he's had that huge boost of the money behind him and the advantages and the privilege. And I suppose the point is, you know, could you perhaps use that to, you know, be a better influence so that you don't have all these little boys thinking, oh, that's funny to laugh at, you know, poor people or whatever. It is lazy. So it was interesting, and HarperCollins has defended him, and some of his books are, I think they say that he, you know, he has a book about a boy who wears a dress and that's okay, and, you know, that he does, you know, he does include diverse characters and so on. So it's, you know, it's interesting. But that's been bubbling away.
Yes.
So I love a Twitter controversy.
You sure do.
But on to our book of the week, Bluebird, Bluebird by Attica Locke. And this has been on my list for ages. I heard it came out a few years ago and I just have been meaning to get to it. So I'm very glad that we have. So Attica Locke is an American author. She was born in Houston, Texas, and now lives in Los Angeles. And she studied initially as a screenwriter, and she's talked about how she wanted to make movies. Mm. That was her ambition. And as a black screenwriter, she wanted to make movies about black characters and racial issues, among other things, and that there just wasn't a market for it, and that sort of fell in a heap. And then the interesting thing that happened, so then she took out a second mortgage on her house to take some time off to start writing a novel, and she became successful with her books Blackwater Rising, The Cutting Season and Pleasantville, which are crime mystery novels. But the interesting thing that then was happening was that all the movies that she'd wanted to make, those stories have moved onto TV. And there was a demand then for her voices like hers to write those stories. And so she became a screenwriter for the show Empire, which has been described, and now I really want to watch it, it's been described as a mix of Dynasty and King Lear. So I'm there for that. I really want to see that now. And she's also written for When They See Us and possibly produced that one, I think, which might be a more serious show, I believe. And she's also one of the screenwriters for Little Fires Everywhere, which is the adaptation, I think produced partly by Reese Witherspoon of the Celeste Ng novel, which did we do it on the podcast?
Not you and I, no. You and Amanda might have done it.
I don't know if we did it on the podcast, but I read it when that came out a few years ago, and I think that's on now, I think on Hulu. But anyway, so she is now in Hollywood again, but this is Bluebird, Bluebird is her latest series. So it's the Highway 59 series, and it's the first one in the series, and it follows Darren Matthews, who's a Texas Ranger, and his area that he operates. So that's like an elite police force.
Yeah, I've never understood the distinction between a sheriff and a ranger, but I think I get the sense that it's more of a state-based, more independent police.
They seem to be above the local police force, but they're not FBI.
No.
But they're a sort of elite in a way, and they range across, sort of he goes up and down the different parts of Highway 59, you know, Texas Highway 59, and the actual highway runs from the bottom of America right up towards Canada, I believe. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of this vein that runs through the middle of the states, and Attica Locke has said how it was a way out of Texas for a long time for a lot of black families, and her family stayed.
Mm.
And so she, I think one of the drivers for her to write this book set in Texas is to reclaim that state in a way, because there are still some white supremacist elements. It's still a racially charged,
divided state.
You know, it's still unsettled and there are still a lot of those elements there. And yet, so it's still difficult to live there as a black woman or as a black family. And she said, but at the same time, that's my home. I love it. And I wanted to write a book set there and claim, you know, my Texas in a sense. And so that's the premise. And it does have a great sense of place, I think. So I was off on the wrong foot with Darren Matthews because I thought he was a park ranger. when I heard about the book, so I was like, why is he investigating murders? But I'll go there. But
Texas happened in a forest.
So Texas Ranger is a different thing. But anyway, so he's
just a cultural nuance that we're missing.
Yeah, that's right. So once I got my head around that, but and it's rare for a minority or for a black man to be, for a black person to be a ranger. So that's still a rarity. In the town of Lark, which is along the Highway 59, a body of a black man is found washed up. And then a couple of days later, the body of a white woman, Missy Dale.
Mm.
And so the story is that that is the reversal of how it usually goes. So the usual case would be that if a body of a white woman is found, then some days later the body of a black man will be found. And the implication is that that has been a revenge killing or a, not even revenge killing, just but
kind of a retributive justice.
A sort of a so-called revenge killing, whether or not that person was guilty, but just because there are these elements of the old KKK and now the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas.
Yep.
And so there are these groups and that is still going on is what we learn. But this in this case, it's been the opposite. So that's a mystery in addition to just the mystery of how did these people die and who might be responsible. And so Darren Matthews is drawn back to work on this case. And so you have the dynamics of there's obviously a local sheriff who's a white man and has a lot of power in that town. And yet Darren Matthews is his sort of superior. Mm. So there's a very interesting dynamic there and there's a lot that he might not be being told. Then you meet the locals and so there's Geneva who has a cafe on the edge of the highway and is very close to the part of the river where one of the bodies was found. And she's been there for a long time. Her husband died a few years ago in a shooting and her son has also died. So she's a really interesting character, complex character. Mm. And then there's the sheriff and then there's, I've forgotten his name, but Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy called Jefferson, Wally Jefferson, who sort of owns most of the town.
Yeah.
And he's this
old money,
extreme position of power. Mm. There's something sinister going on in this town. And there's also, I think he owns the Ice House. And is that like a bar?
I think so.
We're thinking the Ice House is a bar and there's just some really sinister elements there with the white men who hang out there. So that when Darren Matthews walks in, they all stop and look at him.
Yeah.
And it's
menacing.
Menacing, that's the word. So that's the setup. It's had rave reviews. So Anne Patchett says it has both mastered the thriller and exceeded it. Darren Matthews is a tough, honour-bound and profoundly alive in a corrupt world. Yes, so it's Mick Herron described it as the best kind of thriller. It's as literate and thoughtful as it is fast-moving.
Mm. It won the Edgar Allan Poe Award in 2017, I think, and I think it was also longlisted for the Women's Prize the same year.
Yes, so the Edgar Allan Poe Award for crime fiction and the Women's Prize. So it's been I think that's when it came onto my radar around that time. So it's been very highly reviewed and the sequel to it is Heaven My Home, which has come out this year or late last year and I'm dying to read. But tell me, Bluebird, what did you think, Annie?
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, we've been talking about crime and reading a lot of crime recently and I think this is a great, as you say, very atmospheric, full of place. I think the crime itself is in equal parts, which seems really contradictory, but very simple, but also, you know, complex enough with enough twists and turns to keep you reading.
Yes.
I think one of my overwhelming feelings after finishing the book was frustration at how annoying and tedious it is to try and work in this field, or I imagine most fields in Texas, as a black person.
Yes.
That really frustrated me, and I think it is a good idea of what it would be like to try and enact justice, which I think is a key concern of the book. How justice is enacted and whether justice is actually served for the black community that Darren is not consciously looking out for, but feels like he has to step up in more of a way than his white colleagues will.
Well, and he's also looking, he's wanting to solve both murders. So
yeah,
he's
totally
looking out for both the black and the white community, but he's just
whereas
been
the sheriff just
hampered.
Yeah.
And yet that predicament that he's in and a lot of black people face, that you can't then be angry or show your anger about that, because then you're the angry black person.
Exactly. There's so much politicking to do.
So much that he has to keep contained.
Yes.
And it must just be exhausting for
truly.
Him. And he's trying to resist the lure of alcohol, for example, and things like that, where you just think, I just need a drink after this sheriff has just stonewalled this investigation and won't let me get to the suspect who's running around and who knows what he could get up to, or even to eliminate him as a suspect, but just to investigate the thing properly. Yeah. And he, Darren Matthews, still has to be absolutely professional
pristine.
And it just adds another level of difficulty, doesn't it?
So that was kind of one of my overwhelming takeaways from the book. And then I think she's done a really good job of, there are a lot of, you know, very common crime tropes in here. You know, you say he's a hard drinker, he is separated from his wife when we meet him here, there's something untoward going on in his professional career, you know, there's kind of some doubt about whether he'll have a job to go back to. But I think she gives a really interesting social background to each of those kind of hackneyed tropes, you know.
Yes.
So like the alcoholism, turns out his mother was actually an alcoholic and he didn't grow up with her. He grew up with two uncles who raised him. And his mother was the person who gave him his first drink when he was 13. And so there's this kind of simmering.
He's got a very interesting relationship with his mother, hasn't he?
Yeah,
it's
really
not straightforward.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
His wife is a very successful lawyer. They met when he was at law school. She resents the fact that he is always away on the job and putting himself in danger. She sees that his work is kind of, I guess she sees him as trying to be a superhero and wants him to just be safe and stay at home, which you can absolutely understand.
Yes.
And
well, it is dangerous.
Driven them apart.
Yeah.
For the moment.
Well, she thought she was marrying someone who'd become a lawyer.
Yeah, exactly. And that they'd live in Chicago.
That they'd have a lovely sort of urban, lovely, you know, city life.
And he is just drawn back to this rural, less than perfect Texas. But I think, you know, he, like Attica Locke, has that impulse to claim, to lay that claim to the land that he and his forebears grew up on. And I think it's totally justified, because I think, you know, if you give up, then you're kind of letting the bad guys win.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he has this real simmering frustration. One of his uncles, one of his uncles was a ranger as well, and his other uncle was a lawyer. So there was always a bit of tension about which path he would follow.
Yeah.
And he's ended up kind of equivocating, studied law, but ended up being a ranger after an event that happened. And I was trying to look up the name of the person who ended up getting lynched, a black man. And that was, he called it his 9/11. And that was what spurred him to say, you know what, there's only so much we can do within the system of the law. I need to be on the ground sure that, you know, this kind of thing gets prosecuted and kind of gets to trial, because for so many of the black characters in this book, they've suffered losses that never got investigated. And I think towards the end she says something like, black people both face disproportionate representation of being involved in crimes where they don't get investigated by the white lawmakers, and getting accused of crimes that they didn't do by the same people.
Goes,
and so
it's on
they get
both,
it from
both
fronts.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, I thought it was very clever. I really enjoyed it, and I would definitely like to read the second one.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to read the second one. I loved this.
Mm.
It does so much, because it is at its heart a fast-moving crime novel that keeps you turning the page, that has a mystery, a number of interesting characters that you think you know, but you actually, they're more complex than that. And so, you know, you think Missy's husband, for example, is a bad guy, but there might be more to it. Yeah. And so it does, things are revealed as it goes on in a way that's really satisfying and stimulating. It keeps you thinking. But also she does beautifully explore those racial tensions and the dynamics. And but just from the point of view of Darren Matthews, for example, who's a complex character, who's thoughtful, who could have been a lawyer but actually is a very pragmatic, practical person, and that really rings true to me. That I think there are some people who are much more practical, can do, you know, just get it done sort of people, who don't want to waste time in an office when they could be, as you say, on the ground. Yeah. They feel like that's more useful. And so that rang true, that's his, at his heart, that's where he's found his purpose. And much to his wife's disappointment, but it just is where he, you know, feels like he can make a difference. And that's just subtle, but you get that real sense of who he is. And the sense of place, I just loved that openness, the environment, the cafe where Geneva works, and then the ice house or the bar where some of the men hang out and play pool.
It reminded me a bit of Dark Pines. Do you remember that one by Will Dean, where there's just kind of six characters? It's super remote. There's this terrifying big dark forest and all of the characters are a bit weird and clearly have a lot of history together and that's uncomfortable, and lots of things kind of go unsaid and Darren feels very on the outer. There's lots of just little small town politics going on that he can't figure out whether they're important to the case or just simmering resentment, you know.
Yeah, the small town dynamics are really good, and I love that sort of that Twin Peaks kind of feel of that small American town, the diner.
Yeah.
It's very visual. You can sort of see it on screen. And
maybe all the food that she made.
The food.
Sounded amazing.
I know. And you feel like, I can sort of see how Attica Locke has that screenwriting training and background, because she sets the scene really well and it has that strong sense of place, and not just the landscape but the dynamics of the place, the way it is to be in that place and the sort of people who live there and can make your life difficult if you're a black man, even if you're a ranger, and quite overtly too.
Like you know. Which the fact that this book was written in 2016, I think she mentions that quite close to the beginning, and it does just, I mean, this is just my ignorance, feel like the 1970s, you know, like
<That's>
nothing
so true.
Has changed, you know, it just is so depressing that this guy in contemporary Texas has, one of the highest law enforcement roles in the county and still cops this crap, gets called son by the local policeman. Everyone keeps forgetting that he's a ranger conveniently, you know, doesn't get shown the autopsy, gets actively lied to, you know.
Yeah, it is. It does feel like it could be the 70s, and that is depressing, but it also gives the book a timeless feel.
I think her screenwriting chops also come through in the music that runs through the book. There's such a good thread of music. Both the jukebox in the diner and the jukebox in the ice house are always playing very specific setting the tone kind of tunes. So, you know, blues standards and jazz rock and roll, and then country music.
Country music
in the ice house.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a thread of music that's running through in terms of a guitar that appears that has an impact on the plot.
Yeah.
And I think I read in an interview with her, she says that when she reads about racism or experiences racism, she turns back to the blues. I think that must be a real kind of thread of protest and thread of identity connecting her and Darren Matthews to this kind of soul music.
Yeah, it's really good. And I think the title Bluebird, Bluebird, does that come from a John Lee Hooker song? Was that who that was?
I think so.
Yeah, it comes from one of the songs. So, yes, really good. And I didn't guess, it's one of those good crime novels where you sort of think you can guess where it's going or who the culprit might be, or the culprits, given there are two murder cases really. But I didn't quite, you know, you might guess, but then you don't know how or why.
And it's and the why is important, you know, that
so
she makes you care.
It did keep me guessing. So, yeah, really loved it, and I can't wait to read Heaven My Home, which is the next one. So that was a winner, Annie.
Great.
Yes.
Good to hear.
Yeah. So that was Bluebird, Bluebird by Attica Locke. And next week, we're not sure, but we've got a couple of options. We've got The Paying Guests by Sarah Waters. We've got The White Girl by Tony Birch, mm-hmm. which is shortlisted for the Miles Franklin, yep. and that's being announced soon. We're running out of time to read The White Girl.
Maybe we should get that one.
that might have been and gone even by the time this goes up. I don't know. And then we've also got on our list The Vanishing Half by Brit Bennett.
Yes.
A few options lined up. So we'll keep you posted. And in the meantime, you can email us at booksonthegopodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Facebook at Books on the Go. And I'm on Instagram, Twitter and Litzy at A. Bailey Karras. And Annie?
And I'm on Instagram, Litzy and Twitter at Mr. _Annie.
Great. We'll see you next week. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye.